The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Let's start with the Stono Rebellion, which broke out in 1739 in South Carolina. Jumping right in will help me introduce some themes for the rest of the talk. The Stono Rebellion took place in a decade that included many other slave revolts in North America, but also in the Bahamas, in Antigua, and Jamaica. Many places had experienced poor harvests, famine conditions, and epidemic disease. The decade in South Carolina also marked the transition to genuine plantation agriculture, as West Africans brought their skills for rice culture into the New World. It was the slaves who taught the white folks how to do it. 1739 was a better year for farming in South Carolina, but that meant intensive overwork to bring in the harvest. The workforce was hungry and dressed in rags, and the slave drivers pushed them forward with the threat of torture. On September 9th, some number of black men, probably fewer than 20, met at the Stono River, just about 20 miles down the coast from Charleston. They stole some guns from a local store. They killed five white people. They burned a house and marched south with drums and a banner. It's likely that the core of the group was born in Africa and gained some experience as soldiers in a civil war in Congo. They came to a tavern and spared the life of the owner, apparently because he had a reputation for treating his slaves humanely. But the rebels killed the neighbors and burned some more houses. In all, they killed about 21 white people. They cut off the heads of the first couple people and displayed them as a warning to those who might try to stop them. In doing so, it's possible that the rebels were emulating the methods of African war. But public beheading was also a favorite form of punishment that South Carolina's master class already inflicted on rebellious slaves. By coincidence, the lieutenant governor of the colony was riding north toward Charleston and saw the crowd of rebels, which had grown to somewhere between 60 to 100 people. A few rebels chased the lieutenant governor and his four companions, but they escaped and alerted the local militia. On the second day, the militia caught up with the rebels and killed a number of them in a brief battle. At least 30 of the rebels retreated, which is true to the skirmish tactics of West African warfare. And there was a chance that these 30 could rebuild their forces, so the entire white male population was ordered under arms. 1 week into the revolt, the militia won a second battle about 30 miles south of the first. Some black prisoners were shot immediately, while others were hanged or strung up alive. Some were released. Many slaves had held back from joining the rebels, in fact, helping their masters escape to safety. This could have been a purely pragmatic choice, considering the deadly consequences of joining a revolt that was likely to be crushed. The whites kept killing suspected participants for months afterwards and made a final capture of one of the leaders 3 years later. The Stono rebels had been headed in the direction of Spanish Florida, where the authorities offered freedom to Africans who escaped from the English colonies up north. In the 8 years leading up to the Stono Rebellion, the South Carolina Gazette reported that there were already 253 escaped slaves. So there's no question that the rebels knew where they were headed. In 1740, the year after the rebellion, English troops from Georgia and South Carolina attacked the fort in Spanish St. Augustine in Florida, but a combined force of Spaniards, African, and Native Americans repulsed the attack. The English colonists and their American descendants would have to fight repeatedly over the next century to take full control of Florida away from the Spanish, Africans, and the Seminoles. The Stono Revolt is significant for a couple of reasons. For one thing, it was the biggest slave revolt of the North American colonial period. For another, the revolt forced the master class to rethink its methods of repression. In the next year, they wrote the Negro Code of 1740, which influenced the practice of slavery throughout the South. The new code sharpened the color line by establishing various legal disabilities even for free people of color. This was a small group to begin with, but in some towns, it grew later to become a significant middle caste between white people and black slaves, as free people of color. Putting things starkly in terms of color also encouraged the whole white population to identify with the master class. The Negro Code also made it illegal for more than seven black men to gather outside the presence of a white. Slaves were forbidden from striking any white person except in defense of their own master. Whites and Native Americans were offered rewards for hunting fugitive slaves, and it was illegal to teach slaves to write. The Negro Code also made some concessions, such as limiting the work week to 6 days, limiting the work day to 15 hours. That's a concession. And requiring slaves to be provided with adequate food and clothing. My sense is that the only enforceable part of this was the provisions that slaves would get Sundays off. In any case, the 6 day work week became a consistent custom, and that's because the slaves themselves could collectively enforce it by refusing to work. Okay, now that we've had a quick look at Stono, I'll lay out some themes to develop in the rest of the talk. I'll be talking about four more revolts, which I've chosen either for their magnitude or their historical significance. I should say that none of them reached the scale of revolts in the Caribbean, including the most famous and only successful one, which is the Haitian Revolution. Several of the slave colonies in the Caribbean, however, were more than 90% black, which made a big difference. In North America, only some of the rebellions occurred in areas that were majority black, but even where blacks outnumbered the whites, the white minorities were big enough to discourage revolts or to put down the ones that did break out. Even so, there were lots of uprisings. Herbert Aptheker published a path-breaking book in 1943 claiming that there were 250 revolts in North America, a revolt being 10 or more slaves collectively taking up arms to win their freedom. Others have said that this number is too high, but we should remember that the accounts of slave revolts are almost entirely in the voices of panicked white people who didn't want to spread the news that this kind of thing was going on. It's also hard to get a good count because this white panic also sometimes broke out in the absence of any revolt at all. So the exact number we don't know, but we do know that the possibility of revolt shaped the customs, the consciousness, and the institutions of the whole society. Now that brings me to another point. Armed revolt was only one option in a whole spectrum of slave resistance, and we need to see the armed outbreaks in the context of the day-to-day smaller acts of fighting back. This included sabotage of the work process, refusing to work, arson, poisoning, and slaves could run away. And running away could mean different things depending on the context. Some of it was just absenteeism during the heaviest periods of work. It was a way of going on strike. Absentees would generally return, sometimes with a whipping, but also sometimes also with concessions from the masters. Some people ran away to follow friends or loved ones who'd been sold. Some even did this as a way of bargaining to rescind the sale or to be sold themselves to the other master. Some escaped to the cities and got wage jobs from bosses who didn't care where their workers came from. Some ran away in groups and set up all-black colonies. These folks would be known as Maroons. Some Maroon groups were all men, but others set themselves up as families who supported themselves with farming and hunting. Other Maroon groups raided the existing plantations, or they acted as an armed force promoting revolt among slaves who had stayed behind. Just as the master class was always ready for war against rebel slaves, they periodically went to war against the Maroons. For the masters, it just wasn't good to have former slaves living nearby and providing examples to the ones who were still captive. This leads to another major theme, the mental geography of slaves. Take the Maroon colonies. They were seldom big, but they were often in the neighborhood. Maroons had to seek out places like swamps that were both inaccessible, unattractive to the masters as places to make profit. This gave black folks a mental map of where freedom was possible. The slave's sense of geography was not what we learned in school, which is the story of how a U.S. Nation state ended up in its current shape. We've been taught to think of an underground railroad that black folks followed to reach freedom in the North. Now, blacks and their white allies did build this path of escape, but most runaways actually stayed in the South. And if they did look for a place of refuge outside the South, they were just as likely to look outside the United States, to their own South or to the West. I've already mentioned Florida as a magnet for slaves who wanted to escape. For the Southern master class, the Mason-Dixon line was the most secure border. The North was often not the slaves' best hope for freedom, especially since the Constitution gave the masters the right to recapture slaves who escaped into the North. And later on, the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 added federal muscle to slave-catching operations that previously had been private affairs. In general, we should note that the masters tried to keep their slaves in ignorance of the rest of the world. They seem to have succeeded best during the later colonization of the Deep South, with enormous isolated cotton plantations in Mississippi, Alabama, and Louisiana. But we should also be alert to how aware lots of black people were of what was going on in the world. As we saw in the case of the Stono Rebellion, the leaders of the revolt were born into varied experience in Africa, not into a lifetime of slave labor or on a single plantation. It's possible that some of these people knew how to read. In fact, as the cities grew into major export towns of southern commodity crops, slaves and free people of color learned to read by the thousands. In 1791, they read about the outbreak of revolt in Haiti in the same newspapers that white folks were reading. Those who could not read would hear the news from those who could read. What's more, daily commerce put these urban blacks in contact with slaves on nearby plantations, and news could travel 100 miles in a couple of weeks in a so-called Negro telegraph that connected farm to farm. The news could become garbled along this telegraph, but often the truth got through just fine. I'll pick up the sequence of revolts with Gabriel's Rebellion of 1800, but first I wanted to make a few points about blacks in the American Revolution and the impact of the Haitian Revolution, very briefly. When the 13 colonies declared independence in 1776, none of them had yet outlawed slavery, and only two of them would abolish slavery before the century was out. Some revolutionaries, even in the South, were in favor of offering black people freedom in return for service in the war against the British. About 9,000 black people did fight on the American side, but only a handful of them actually got emancipated as a result. The British governor, Dunmore of Virginia, did offer freedom to slaves who fought for the British, and 300 served on that side. Thousands of black people did gain their freedom during the Revolution, but mostly by running away. No doubt some of them absorbed the revolutionary ideology of liberty, but I think the main thing was that the war against the British was distracting the masters from the job of repressing the slaves. That's a general point. The black folks had a better chance of rising up and getting free when their masters faced an external enemy, whether it was the Spanish, Native American, or British. Okay, now just a few words about the Haitian Revolution. If you missed Michael Ehrenreich's talk yesterday, you should check out the recording when it becomes available. I won't go through the chronology, except to say slaves in the French colony of Saint-Domingue rose up in 1791 and fought a series of wars to finally win their freedom in 1803. That's 12, 13 years. Many North American blacks took courage from the news, which came in the same year that a confederacy of Native Americans delivered a major defeat to the U.S. Army in western Ohio. And soon, white farmers in the West rose up in the Whiskey Rebellion, including some in the backcountry of North Carolina and Virginia. Add to this the economic depression and southern produce that was going on at the time, and we have the context for Gabriel's Rebellion in Richmond, Virginia in 1800. Gabriel was a slave trained as a blacksmith who knew how to read and write. he and his wife Nanny, his two brothers, and another slave named Jack Bowler, all prepared weapons and co-conspirators for months. In August, however, two other slaves reported a plot to the authorities. Governor James Monroe, future president, activated the state militias. Meanwhile, according to Apthecker, about 1,000 slaves, some mounted, armed with clubs, scythes, homemade bayonets, and a few guns, appeared at a rendezvous 6 miles outside the city, Richmond. But attack was not possible because a major rainstorm had made the road into town impassable. Okay, the end of the quote. In the next few days, dozens of black folks were arrested, and the authorities offered a $300 reward to anybody who turned in Gabriel. The slave who turned him in was hoping to buy his freedom with the reward, but he only got $50. At least 35 people were hanged. Apthecker referred to them as conscious revolutionists, and not one of them who was condemned betrayed the cause. There are signs that Gabriel's rebels intended to take Richmond and hold it as a revolutionary outpost, not to flee someplace else for freedom. If so, this is a pretty bold plan, considering that slaves in Virginia made up less than 40% of the population. Congressman John Randolph wrote that week, "The accused have exhibited a spirit which, if it becomes general, must deluge the southern country in blood. They manifested a sense of their rights and contempt of danger and a thirst for revenge which portend the most unhappy consequences." Unquote. We should also take note of whom the rebels planned to spare. They were not to kill Methodists, Quakers, or Frenchmen. Methodists and Quakers were well known as abolitionists, and Gabriel's conspirators knew that France, at least for the moment, had granted freedom to the slaves in Haiti. The rebels were also counting on at least some support from poor whites, and some poor whites might have been in on the plot from the beginning. News of the rebellion seems to have stirred up a two-year stretch of slave resistance in the rest of Virginia. Gabriel's rebellion impacted the North, too. The revolt was a factor in resolutions by all the remaining northern states to begin the gradual emancipation of black people. One last note on the consequences of the revolt. James Monroe created the Richmond Public Guard, in other words, the Richmond Police, right after he put down Gabriel's rebellion. If Gabriel's rebellion had gotten off the ground, it would have been the biggest in U.S. history. Now I'll turn to the one that was the biggest. The New Orleans Rebellion of 1811, also known as the German Coast Uprising. The rebellion came out of the sugar plantations upriver from New Orleans. Here I should explain something about the structure of authority on plantations, because it's relevant. On plantations of any size, there were usually two layers of sub-commanders below the master. One of them would be a paid white overseer who served as the overall manager of the slaves, of the field slaves. Below the overseer would be one or more drivers who would generally be slaves themselves. The drivers took care of the hour-by-hour discipline of the field slaves, and they would often be the ones to inflict the tortures, such as whipping. These two layers of buffers between the masters and the field hands allowed the master to stand majestically above these brutal relations, at least in his own mind. He might sometimes stay the hand of the overseer or the driver and dispense mercy, even though as a profit-minded man, he was also constantly telling the overseer to push the slaves to their limit. All this is important because one of the plantation drivers on the German coast played a key role in building a liberation army. Charles de Londe kept up appearance as a harsh driver, but as a driver, he was also allowed more freedom of movement than field hands were. On the pretext of visiting a wife on another plantation, de Londe recruited revolutionaries up and down the river in 1811. Two of them, named Cook and Quamana, had been warriors on the African Gold Coast. Even before the Louisiana Purchase transferred the territory to American hands in 1803, slave masters had thrown investment into sugar plantations because exports from Haiti, which was the world's biggest producer, were interrupted during the revolution. More production required the import of more slaves. So Cook and Quamana and others, they weren't the only ones who had the experience of a broader world. They came from Africa, they came from the Caribbean. And here is Dan Rasmussen, who wrote the only book-length treatment of the German Coast Uprising. Quote, nowhere in America was slavery as exploitative or were profits as high as in the cane fields of Louisiana. Slaves worked longer hours, faced more brutal punishments, and lived shorter lives than any other slave society in North America. At the same time, many of the slaves were acutely aware of the example of the Haitian revolutionaries. In 1811, the governor let his guard down by dispatching the militia to support an Anglo land grab in Spanish West Florida. At the time, Florida's panhandle extended all the way to the Mississippi and included Baton Rouge, a key strategic point on the river that the United States didn't control. As ever, the local master class and the federal government were trying to swallow up as much of Spanish Florida as they could. They wanted more land for plantations, but they also wanted to destroy Florida as a sanctuary for escaped slaves. On the January day appointed for the revolt, this is when the militia is away in Spanish Florida, the Louisiana revolutionaries began to trying to kill their own masters. That's where they started. Unfortunately, one of them got away wounded and was later to rally local whites to counterattack. Meanwhile, the rebels met up with more of their supporters. They walked down the levee along the Mississippi in the direction of New Orleans. Here again, the objective seems to have been to take New Orleans with help from blacks who lived there and turn it into a fortified center that slaves throughout the region would be drawn to. Over the next 24 hours, the rebel force grew to something between 200 and 500 with the addition of Maroons who rose from the swamps. Many were mounted and some were dressed in stolen militia uniforms. The rebels set up a resting point to which they would draw the small armed force that the government had been able to, governor had been able to send against them. And these soldiers and sailors attacked, but the rebels were nowhere to be found, which all seems like a tactic from African guerrilla war. The white force that actually did catch up with the rebels was composed of the local masters that the first wounded escapee had been able to put together, actually a larger force than the militia. These whites won a major battle and began reprisals against the rebels when they were in retreat. Charles de Londe had his hands cut off, his legs broken, and then was shot before his body was roasted on a pile of straw. The master class cut off the heads of 100 others and put them on pikes on the levee for miles on end. Then 29 more were hanged. Cook and Quamana were captured and executed without implicating anyone. They didn't talk. Only two white people died in the uprising. The newspapers made very little of the revolt, and this relative silence accounts for the virtual erasure of the revolt from the historical record. I would guess that most people here have not heard of this one. Before I leave off talking about the region, though, I should mention another significant battle that involved escaped slaves in West Florida. In the year following the German Coast Uprising, the War of 1812 broke out, and the British sent troops into the weakly defended South Florida, or Spanish Florida. They hoped to enlist the help of Native Americans and escape blacks to harass the Americans on the southern flank. In the Florida Panhandle, along the Apalachicola River, the British constructed a fort before they withdrew in 1815. Here's something from Adam Wasserman, who wrote People's History of Florida, which is too big to carry around. Quote, the fort grew from a strategically defensive base to a flourishing free black community. Blacks cultivated fields and plantations extending 50 miles up the river. The blacks successfully applied their knowledge of rice cultivation techniques from West Africa to Florida's tropical climate. Runaway slaves began pouring in on a daily basis. The community grew to about 1,000 blacks in the fields surrounding the fort. A total of 300 black men, women, and children were in possession of the fort, accompanied by about 20 Choctaws and a number of Seminoles. That's the end of the quote. The place became known as Negro Fort. At the same time, unfortunately, General Andrew Jackson had troops within striking distance. Good. He had recently taken land in Alabama and Mississippi away from the Lower Creek Indians, an area about the size of Indiana that would be perfect for later cotton plantations. Then Jackson set out to destroy the free black settlement along the Apalachicola. Negro Fort was extremely well armed with guns and explosives, maybe too well armed, because it made it vulnerable to a single red-hot cannonball, which ignited the arms depot in a major explosion and killed 270 people instantly. There were only 60 left alive. Then the federal soldiers set about hunting down the black people in the neighboring area, not to kill them, but to return them to slavery. The attack on Negro Fort did not put an end to resistance from blacks and Seminoles in Florida, but it did push the threat further south. Along with the repression of the German coast uprising and the displacement of the Lower Creek Indians, the destruction of Negro Fort thus helped make the Deep South safe for slavery just when cotton was becoming king. The same logic would later apply to the movement to take Texas away from Mexico. In a moment, I'll move on to the Denmark Vesey conspiracy in Charleston. But before I do that, I want to note some of the differences between city slaves and plantation field hands. Field hands had the most reason to rise up against their masters, but they also tended to have the narrowest outlook and the lowest horizon of hope. Frederick Douglass, the country's most famous escape slave, wrote that making a slave work 80 hours a week was a more effective method of breaking a spirit than even a whipping was. The German Coast Revolt came out of the plantations, but its key leaders were a slave driver and two men who had experiences of freedom as warriors in Africa. Gabriel of Virginia was raised in the country, but trained as a blacksmith and spent time in the city of Richmond. He could read and write. He met a great variety of people, free and slave, including free people of color, and his skilled occupation gave him a sense of his own worth. Many urban slaves were hired out as wage laborers. Douglass himself worked in a shipyard in Baltimore along white workers, and that made him think. "I was living among free men," he wrote, "and was in all respects equal to them by nature and attainments. Why should I be a slave? I was now getting $1.50 a day. I worked for it, and it was rightfully my own, and yet every Saturday night this money was taken from me by my master. Why should he have it? I owed him nothing." Some masters did take all of the slaves' wages, but many found it convenient to let their slaves find their own jobs while collecting a flat fee for the time the slaves spent away from the house. That meant the slaves could make cash for themselves in the cities if they earned more than the fees that they paid their masters. In Charleston, hundreds of slave women were engaged in paid needlework and the trading of produce and craft goods. Hundreds of slave men worked for wages, the majority moving goods from place to place because the city was a major port. Many African Americans could even afford to live outside their masters' households. Slaves could marry and cohabit independently. Some skilled artisans even began hiring wage workers themselves. Maybe most important, an unsupervised collective life of blacks in Charleston and other cities developed in ways that were impossible on a plantation. Free people of color built schools for their children. Black churches were founded. Everybody met out on the streets, and they gathered in the markets on Sundays. Denmark Vesey was a slave on board ship with his master in the Caribbean in the 1780s and 90s. He spent a year as a teenager in Haiti, before the revolution broke out. And his master, and he settled in Charleston in the 1790s. Then in the year 1800, Vesey won the lottery and bought his freedom. He was a successful carpenter. When a branch of the African Methodist Episcopal Church opened up in 1818, he became a Sunday school teacher. About a third of the city's black population, more than 4,000 people, belonged to the AME Church. The church was home to several strands of abolitionism, from the most gradual to the most militant. Now, 4 years later, in 1822, Vesey was accused of conspiring with several other members of the church to mount the biggest slave insurrection in history, U.S. history. The other center of conspiracy was the skilled trades and wage workers, not the personal house slaves who tended to be much more loyal to their masters. One of those house slaves told his own master that the rebels had tried to recruit him. So word of the plot made its way to the mayor, who put the city on a military lockdown on the supposed day of revolt. According to some accounts, the conspiracy included thousands of slaves, including many on plantations around the city, surrounding the city. They were to set fire to the city, acquire weapons, kill any whites who got in the way, and maybe even sail out of the harbor to Haiti. This last was not really far-fetched, considering the number of free black sailors who came in and out of the port all the time, and the fact that every Charleston harbor pilot was black. Another possibility was that the conspirators, like Gabriel and Charles Delonge, aimed to take the city, fortify it, and hold it. The authorities hanged 35 of the supposed leaders and exiled another 27. The mayor approved the arson of the AME Church, which became an underground congregation until the end of the Civil War. Just an 8-minute walk away from the ashes of that church, the state built an armory known as the Citadel, which served as quarters for a militia that specialized in harassing urban blacks. The Citadel also became a military academy that still exists today. From now on, free black sailors who arrived in port would go straight to jail and then be released only when their ship sailed. Other southern states soon picked up this blatantly unconstitutional law. In general, there's a raft of new measures to repress both free people of color and black slaves. There's a problem with the story of the conspiracy, though. It could all be a fabrication. There's no doubt that Vesey and some others refused to subordinate themselves to anybody and express some militant ideas. Vesey was known for chastising other blacks who bowed and scraped to the whites. Nevertheless, the story of the conspiracy is based on secret interrogation of a handful of prisoners who were subjected to torture and solitary confinement. And the exception to that is when they put a couple of prisoners together to get their story straight. It's possible, of course, that the whole thing is true and that the central figures of the conspiracy heroically went to their deaths without admitting anything, or they might have refused to confess because they didn't do anything. Right now, historians are in a major controversy over the Vesey affair. A reexamination of the evidence started 15 years ago with a 60-page article in a journal. I've read it. I'm afraid now that I'm one of the skeptics. The case does look pretty flimsy, but that means I'm not sure what to believe. It doesn't mean that I disbelieve it. Like I said, it could have happened, but the other possibility is important too. The possibility that South Carolina entered into a period of mass murder and heightened repression against black people on the basis of a white panic and nothing else. The fact that both stories are plausible tells us a lot about what life was like in the Old South. The last revolt I'll discuss is Nat Turner's, but first I'll say a few words about a propagandist of black revolt, David Walker. There's very little that we hear in the voices of black rebels themselves, outside of the confessions that they supposedly made when they were in custody. In this way, David Walker stands out. He was born free in 1796 or so in Wilmington, North Carolina, and almost certainly moved to Charleston as a young man. There's a good chance he was in Charleston during the crackdown in 1822, and he was already a member of the AME Church. He might have known a number of the people who were hanged. Later, when he was living in Boston, he wrote The Appeal to the Colored Citizens of the World, which I highly recommend. This pamphlet, published in 1829, that is between Vesey and Turner, was strongly infused with the religion of the African church and made a systematic defense of black armed struggle. He argued that Southern slavery was the worst form of slavery in history, that black people were born and should be by right equal to white people, and therefore they had the right to rise up and take their freedom by force of arms if necessary. Much of what he says sounds like ideas that were also attributed to Vesey, who of course belonged to the same church. Vesey and Walker emphasized that God was on the side of the slaves, but in the words of Walker, the Lord would not drag black people by their hair into freedom. It's something they had to do themselves. Okay. I'm running long, I'm sorry. The pamphlet also makes the case for killing people in the course of insurrection. He considers one instance, an actual instance, and we've already seen a couple of others, where the rebels let somebody get away who ended up bringing reinforcements to kill the rebels. If slaves had the right to rise up, said Walker, and they knew that others would try to kill them for doing so, then insurrectionary killing was really a case of self-defense. Walker wrote, "It is no more harm for you to kill a man who was trying to kill you than it is for you to take a drink of water when thirsty." Walker constructed these arguments and wrote these bold words for distribution in the South. It's an appeal to colored people, not a plea to the conscience of white folks. White people could redeem themselves if they renounced this crime of slavery, but black people shouldn't wait around for that. Walker's idea was to send the pamphlet into the South and develop discussion circles where one black person would read the text out loud to other people who couldn't read. This is the kind of thing that would explain why free black sailors were being forbidden to mix with other black people in Southern ports. Walker died 2 years later, and we don't know how much impact the pamphlet really had in the South. It certainly stoked the panic of the master class, and Walker was blamed for all manner of insubordination, including Turner's revolt. For us, the greatest significance of the pamphlet may be as an indicator of what a section of black people were thinking. It's clear from the way he writes it that not all black folks agreed with him, but it's also clear that the arguments about how to get free were going on everywhere. What's more, self-conscious black revolutionaries were a part of the discussion many decades before the Civil War. Now about Nat Turner. Born in 1800, he lived in Southampton, a majority black rural county in southeast Virginia. Most farms in the area had fewer than 10 slaves. White and black people alike acknowledged Turner's unusual intelligence. He was also a preacher who had visions, including a vision about when the first should be last and the last should be first. In August 1831, Turner assembled just a half a dozen committed militant slaves and started that night to kill men, women, and children on farm after farm, whites. The plan was to gather black supporters as they went along, and it worked for a while, and as the number of participants grew to around 60 or 80, including at least one woman, which was unusual. One witness later told the Richmond Inquirer, indiscriminate slaughter was not their intention after they obtained a foothold, and was resorted to in the first instance to strike terror and alarm. That's the end of it. They also spared a family of poor whites because those people didn't act superior to black people. Turner was trying to get to the town of Jerusalem, where he believed there was a good supply of weapons. It's not clear whether he intended to stand and fight or move further east toward the Great Dismal Swamp, where already a couple of thousand Maroons were living. In any case, he didn't make it to Jerusalem. By the third day, hundreds of soldiers and militia members had assembled to kill and capture the rebels. Turner escaped for a couple weeks. Then he was tried like some of the others and hanged, but not before a local slaveholder interviewed him in jail and produced what he called the Confessions of Nat Turner. This is the report of a witness who referred to Turner as diabolical, but there isn't any more reliable a report of what Turner ever said. He admitted everything, regretted nothing, and when he got to court, he pled not guilty because he didn't feel guilty. The repercussions were huge. In Southampton County alone, whites slaughtered at least, somewhere between 100 and 200 blacks. Turner's raid had killed 57. Gabriel's revolt had stirred up Virginia, but Turner's shook the whole South. As Apthecker wrote, the uprising was infectious and slaves everywhere became restless, or at least it was believed that they had become restless, so that the terror, momentarily localized in Virginia, spread up to Delaware and through Georgia, across to Louisiana and into Kentucky. There were lynchings, arrests, executions, and a new round of repressive legislation throughout the region. Turner's Rebellion was not the largest slave revolt, but historically it was the most significant. The South settled into decades of its most harsh repression, including stepped up persecution of free blacks and censorship of Southern abolitionists. Many of those who could move north did so, including the most prominent black educator in Charleston and two of the most famous white abolitionists. The Grimké sisters, they left in the 1830s and never came back. They went to the north. Slave revolts did continue until emancipation, but they didn't ramp up again in intensity until the period of the Civil War itself. And I'll leave off here with two reflections. First, as I said before, the conditions for a revolt were most favorable when the master class was distracted by some external threat, like the Spanish or the English or the Indians. In these terms, we can see the Civil War as the moment when the Mason-Dixon line changed from the South's most secure border into its most threatening frontier. It was this threat that allowed the slaves of the South to come forward and finally take their freedom by all forms of revolt, including armed combat. The fact that slavery ended this way in the Civil War is one reason we've been taught to see slave revolt within a national framework. But we should remember that before the Civil War, lots of slaves operated with a mental geography that featured many paths to freedom, not just toward a single beacon in the North. The second and last reflection is based on something that David Walker wrote. He said that Southern slavery was worse than any previous cases of slavery because places like Greece and Rome took their slaves by defeating people in war, and there was something honorable in that. American slavery, though, was more insidious because it was racial. Masters tried to convince themselves and their captives that black people should serve under whites forever because black folks were inferior. That's all true, but I'm stuck on his earlier point, which is that slavery is a product of war. I think that the history of American slave revolts and the history of repression shows that slavery could be sustained only through repeated campaigns of warfare, not metaphorical warfare, as we might speak of class war today, but continual or organized armed struggle. And it's no wonder that the master class could only be overthrown when it finally was defeated on the battlefield.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.